This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It just keeps getting harder to keep up with the amount of information that we have to absorb and produce. Caffeinated coffee is a popular pick-me-up, but lately a growing number of students and working people have been using prescription drugs to help stimulate their focus and concentration. Drugs that weren't intended to do this and that aren't prescribed for this purpose. Drugs that are prescribed for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, narcolepsy, and Alzheimer's disease. Their off-label use as neuroenhancers raises many ethical as well as medical questions. My guest, Margaret Talbot, examines those questions in her article, Brain Gain, published in the current edition of The New Yorker. Talbot is a staff writer for the magazine. She says people who take neuroenhancing drugs are using them like steroids for the brain, hoping for a brain boost, a cognitive edge. Margaret Talbot, welcome to Fresh Air. One neurologist who you spoke to coined the term cosmetic neurology, using drugs developed for serious mental deficits to improve ordinary cognitive function. An interesting term. What are some of the drugs that fit in this category, and what are they typically prescribed for?
Yes, I love that term, and I think it's quite descriptive of the phenomenon. The main drugs, I would say, that are being used this way now are the drugs Adderall and Ritalin, which are stimulants that are used widely for to treat ADHD in children.
Which
and
is
adults.
Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Exactly. And the other one is a newer drug that I think perhaps fewer people may have heard of. The brand name is Provigil. The generic is Modafinil. And it's a drug that was developed to treat the sleeping disorder narcolepsy and came out with approval for that use in 1998. The stipulated uses have expanded a bit. So now it can, it's stated on the label, be used for the kind of excessive daytime sleepiness that might be associated with shift work, people who work nights, or sleep apnea. But off-label and kind of ad hoc, people have been taking it to improve their focus, promote wakefulness, and they think give them an edge, a mental edge.
Apparently, a lot of students on college campuses are using these neuroenhancers now. You spoke to somebody who's used a lot of them who didn't want his real name used. But
yes.
Tell us what he had to tell you about how he used them and how he thought they helped him.
Yes. Well, this was a student who had graduated from Harvard recently. In the piece, I call him Alex. He had been one of these really busy, kind of overcommitted people. He had a lot of extracurriculars. He ran a big student organization. He wrote a lot of research papers, about 12 a semester, and he wanted to have some fun as well. He told me, you know, he didn't want to completely miss out on his youth. So he felt that basically he had this impossible life. He was so overscheduled, and yet he didn't want to give any of it up, and he wanted to get good grades, and so he started taking Adderall. He got a doctor to prescribe it for him. He was familiar with the symptoms of ADHD because he had a brother who had been diagnosed with it, and he basically would take it pretty regularly, but in order to power through the papers he had to write, go to all the meetings he wanted to go to, and do as well as he thought he should be doing in college without giving anything up.
Now, I mean, college students for years have drunk cups and cups and cups of coffee or taken caffeine pills like No-Doze. What's the
Sure.
difference between taking these, you know, new drugs like Ritalin
Right.
versus taking either, you know, old school amphetamines or, you know, caffeine?
I think what's different about this is, first of all, they are prescription medications that people are taking often without a doctor's prescription or approval. Oftentimes on college campuses, people are getting friends who have prescriptions because they have a diagnosis of ADHD to sell them the drugs or give them the drugs. So they're taking them without a doctor's supervision. And that's significant because I think people, a lot of college students in particular, tend to think of these drugs as really benign because they've grown up with so many people who had the ADHD diagnosis, so many schoolmates who were taking the drugs, that they tend to think of them as not something you need to worry about, really. But they do have side effects, and particularly if you are taking them without knowledge of somebody who knows your medical history, because they're stimulants, they have the kinds of effects you might guess stimulants would have, the kind of unwanted effects as well as the kind of desired effects, difficulty going to sleep when you want to go to sleep, loss of appetite, headaches, sometimes unexpected spikes in blood pressure. I think for older people, especially, they can also carry a risk of various cardiac problems. And also, they carry a risk of dependence as well, according to the FDA labeling on them.
Do we know what Ritalin or Provigil, two of the drugs that are being used now as neuroenhancers, what they do to the brain to increase the focus or give you more mental energy?
It's interesting. Provigil, which they call an atypical stimulant, they really don't understand the mechanism by which it works. It may increase dopamine levels. It may have a number of effects, sort of global effects on the brain that we don't really understand. A little bit more is known about the mechanisms of the stimulants that have been around longer, like Adderall and Ritalin. But I think that a lot of neurologists will tell you, we don't really know the long-term impacts of some of these drugs. And interestingly, some of the neurologists I talked to said, you know, there are physical side effects to be concerned about, but you could also talk about cognitive side effects. Usually you don't improve one aspect of thinking without taking some kind of potential toll on another. So there are a couple of researchers, for example, I talked to at UPenn, Anjan Chatterjee and Martha Farah, who are looking at what impact these drugs might have on creativity, creative thinking. They seem to, in laboratory tests, help on, you know, tasks that require focus, that require really bearing down on something. And in certain kinds of tests, like remembering a string of numbers forwards and backwards and that kind of thing, they do show a real benefit. But would that kind of focus actually have a dampening effect on creativity? I think all of us have had the experience of getting a great idea when we're not, in fact, hyper-focused on something, but when we're out, you know, walking the dog or in the shower. And so that kind of thinking doesn't seem to be aided by these new cognitive enhancers.
Well, we mentioned that a lot of students, college students, are using these drugs to help them focus on their work, their term papers. There's other people who you talk to who have found it useful in what they're doing. For instance, a champion poker player.
That's right. Yes. His name is Paul Phillips, and I came across him because he's actually written about the benefits he thought he got from taking Provigil before he went out on the world poker tournament circuit. And he feels that it really helped him to focus and to take in a lot of information about the other players without feeling overwhelmed or overstimulated. And he really felt that it increased his earnings.
You know, although neuroenhancers have been called like brain steroids, and compared to what steroids do for athletes, they are not banned, for instance, from poker competitions.
That's right. They're not banned. And so anybody can take them. And there, I think people are fairly open about taking them in those situations. And, you know, many people say they are akin to steroids. And, you know, that's another issue, whether an ethical issue that's raised by these, I think, which is whether they constitute a form of cheating. I think on college campuses where you do hear a lot about these drugs, there is some discussion, especially among students and especially among students who aren't taking them, about whether this is fair. You know, if you are going into an exam, because, for example, the student that I spoke to, one of the kinds of purposes he used it for was, you know, before he went in to take an exam, he would pop an Adderall. So I think some students wonder, well, is that really fair if other people aren't getting that advantage? And should you have to report that you're taking the drug?
And I should say, particularly if you're being graded on a curve.
Particularly if you're being graded on a curve. Now, it's a little hard to imagine how that would work. I can't imagine really, you know, some of our students at our finer institutions having to pee into a cup before they're given their blue books. But, you know, I think it is a legitimate question to raise.
Now, another use that you mentioned in your article is that you say the Air Force distributes one of these neuroenhancers, modafinil, to pilots on long missions.
That's right. The Department of Defense, actually, in general, was one of the first kind of entities in society to take an interest in modafinil when it became available and started testing it on pilots who go on long missions and funded a lot of the early research on it. And now the Air Force makes modafinil available to them. And that raises an interesting question, I think, which is, will this be something that employers will be inclined to hand out? It may be tempting for employers in the future.
To suggest that perhaps your performance will be enhanced with these drugs.
Exactly. And that you will be able to be much more productive and working long hours. I mean, after all, that's kind of a direction we're going in society anyway.
But in a way, your employer doesn't even need to encourage you if you're competing with other people in the workplace for a promotion or just to keep your job. You might feel the need to do that to keep or to get a competitive edge.
Well, that's right. I think that's actually a real issue because there are subtle forms of coercion that I think we all feel. Actually, when the scientific journal Nature did an informal poll of its readers last year asking whether they took drugs like this at grant times or under deadline pressure and so on, most of these readers were presumably scientists or academics. They got 1,400 responses, and 1 out of 5 of the people said that they did take the drugs like Provigil and Adderall and Ritalin for sort of cosmetic neurology purposes, if you will. And interestingly, a third of the people who were polled said that if they knew that parents at their children's school were giving their children these drugs, not for a medical diagnosis, but just to give them an extra edge, that these people would feel also pressured to give their own kids, even though they didn't really believe in it. And a third of the people who responded to this poll said that they would feel that kind of pressure. And then there is just the more, the feeling that I get as I was reporting this story, for example, I would mention, you know, to colleagues that I was doing it, and kind of a surprising, you know, number of people said, oh yeah, I've taken Provigil, I take it for deadlines. And then I don't actually use these drugs. But part of me was thinking, gosh, is this why this person is so much more productive? Is this why, you know, I'm so behind on my deadline? You know, and you do feel that maybe you're not quite keeping up. And I think there's a lot of that pressure in our society today anyway to work longer hours and be more productive. And this is just another agent in that trend, I think, that's important to look at.
My guest is Margaret Talbot. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and in the current edition, she has an article called Brain Gain, The Underground World of Neuro-Enhancing Drugs. And we'll talk more about these drugs after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about new neuro-enhancing drugs. These are drugs that were created for other purposes, like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, drugs like Ritalin and Adderall, that are now being used by a lot of people to increase their focus and productivity, either students or people on the job, pilots, things along those lines. And my guest, Margaret Talbot, is the author of the piece Brain Gain, The Underworld of Neuroenhancing Drugs, which is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. We've talked about why some people feel that they benefit from taking these neuroenhancing drugs. But from the research you've done, do they have like an equal benefit for everyone, or only certain people more likely to feel a benefit from drugs like this?
Individually, I think some people probably, you know, get some placebo effect if they believe in this strongly. Also, in the research that's been done, and there is some data on these drugs in healthy, you know, non-mentally impaired people, where people are given a dose of, say, Provigil, and then asked to perform certain kinds of laboratory tasks that test focus and memory. And in general, they do show an improvement, not across the board, but they show an improvement for most tasks in the studies that have been done. However, they seem to show, interestingly, that they help people more who are kind of in the middle range of intellectual ability than people who are at the higher range, which is kind of surprising, I think. It seems like you might expect it to make smart people smarter. And I think what it seems to suggest is maybe there's kind of a ceiling. If you do quite well at a given memory test, say, already, there's only so much room for improvement. And that may have some real-world applications, too, that these drugs may help people go from kind of the mid-range or high mid-range a little higher in their capacity to do various kinds of jobs and not really help people at the highest end.
Now, you've talked about some of the drugs that are being used as neuroenhancers to increase mm-hmm. focus and productivity. And there's another class of drugs that are being used or look like they might be on the verge of being used this way. And these are drugs that were originally created for things like Alzheimer's disease, for memory mm-hmm. impairment. Can you talk about those drugs?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about this is this kind of neuropharmaceutical area is really booming because we have an aging population and people who are working longer or want to be able to work longer. And we also have, obviously, you know, the Alzheimer's problem and the memory impairments that come with that. So there are a number of drugs in development that work on various receptors in the brain, many of them with the aim of treating Alzheimer's patients, some with the aim of treating other kinds of cognitive impairments that are associated with mental illnesses like schizophrenia. That's the purpose of these drugs. You know, some of them eventually may also trickle down into the kind of uses I'm talking about here, where people are getting a hold of them one way or another and taking them to give themselves a cognitive boost when they don't have a recognized impairment or diagnosis. And some of them, eventually the uses may be expanded for them too, and what we consider to be unacceptable cognitive decline may also change. You know, the kind of memory loss that a lot of people accept, mild memory loss that a lot of people accept with middle age now, people may no longer feel is acceptable and may be willing to take a drug that helps with that in the future. So I think that may be a direction we're moving in.
One person who you quote in your article who supports the use of these neuroenhancers says, why would you want an upward limit on the intellectual capabilities of a human being? And, you know, that's a pretty convincing way of putting it. On the other hand, one of the things I worry about is that if there's this cosmetic neurology that starts happening, it risks creating a new normal in the way that cosmetic surgery creates a new normal. Suddenly, like, there's so many people who never have wrinkles, so it's no longer normal to have wrinkles as you get older. It's normal to be wrinkle-free in a lot of circles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't do that, you're the one who looks abnormal.
Right. I think that the argument you cite by the person who says, why would you want an upper limit on, you know, intellectual capabilities, is something to keep in mind. And I think you're hearing it, including from scientists and neurologists who work in this area. And, you know, their argument is, well, this even has some trickle-down benefits for society. If people who are very smart and are working on cures for diseases and so on, if they are, you know, smarter and more productive, then that will benefit all of us. The British Medical Association came out with a report where, among other arguments, they made that argument. They said, you know, generally making people smarter is considered a good thing. So what, you know, why would we not want that? There's also, I guess, the social inequality argument, which is that this is the kind of thing, like so many benefits that accrue to people at the upper ends of the economic ladder. You know, that this is the kind of people who will get access to these drugs, who will have the savvy to go to a doctor and describe the kind of symptoms that would get them a prescription, who will know about them, whose parents will know about them, are also the kind of people who already, you know, are getting extra help in the form of SAT tutoring or whatever it is, and who already are going to the best schools or whose parents can afford to send them to the best schools, so that it would, you know, there's an argument that it could compound social inequalities that we are already at least somewhat concerned about.
One study that you cite in your New Yorker article says that it's predominantly white males going to Northeast colleges who are members of fraternities who use these neuroenhancing drugs. What's the interpretation of that?
Well, the authors of the study are fairly careful not to extrapolate too much from it, but I think it's an interesting suggestive finding. you know, you can imagine that college campuses that are more competitive and have, you know, higher standards to get in and where people feel a fair amount of academic pressure to keep up, you know, would be more likely to be laboratories of this kind of experimentation. I mean, on this point, I'm just guessing, but fraternities, I would imagine, would be places where people could trade them amongst themselves with greater ease. One of the things that was interesting to me is trying to look a little bit at how people get these drugs on campus. And there are these websites called BoardEt, where students who are in their libraries at their various institutions and ostensibly studying are sort of sending notes to one another on this computer board. And a lot of them, I mean, it's quite common to find on there queries about buying or selling or trading Adderall and Ritalin. And some of the universities where I looked at these sites were some of the leading Ivy League institutions. And so I think that that academic pressure and academic competitiveness is one of the forces contributing to the use of these drugs.
Margaret Talbot, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Margaret Talbot is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article, Brain Gain, The Underground World of Neuroenhancing Drugs, is published in the current edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.